The first has to do with the question of revolutionary violence in contemporary situations of ecocide like the Niger Delta. While many of my students found themselves radicalized by what they were learning about oil in Nigeria, and thus could begin to imagine answering Fanon's revolutionary call nearly 60 years after his death, I found myself horrified to recognize 14 years after Ken Saro-Wiwa's death that one could plausibly begin to explain the contemporary situation of the Niger Delta as a consequence of Saro-Wiwa's campaign for more political autonomy, revenue sharing, and community development for those who live in the midst of petroleum extraction, as well as his campaign against the monopoly of violence wielded by state and oil, wielded by the state and oil companies against local residents. Reading The Curse of the Black Gold, one learns of legal and political developments in Nigeria over the past decade. Saro-Wiwa was executed in 1995. So one learns of developments that might be seen as representing the achievement of some of Saro-Wiwa's objectives. This is the whole quote. In the 1990 Ogoni Bill of Rights, Saro-Wiwa called for political control of Ogoni affairs by Ogoni people, the right to the control and use of a fair proportion of Ogoni economic resources for Ogoni development, adequate and direct representation as a right for Ogoni people in all Nigerian national institutions, and the right to protect the Ogoni environment and ecology from further degradation. And the first two of these have kind of been addressed in some nominal way in Nigeria. Yet the subsequent proliferation of local political entities based largely on ethnicity, the funneling of some increased percentage of oil revenues to them, and the oil companies' embrace of a rhetoric of community development has resulted not, as Saro-Wiwa would have hoped, in a livable Niger Delta, a just Nigeria, in poet Obaga Ufuoro's words, but rather in the localization and minority ethnicization of previously nationalized corruption among the ethnic majority. And an explosion, indeed a perverse democratization of violence. In other words, instead of violence and money being kept at the center, they've been disseminated locally into the Niger Delta. Violence in the Niger Delta is no longer top-down, the monopoly of the state and oil multinationals, but rather pervasive, capillary, inter-ethnic and intra-ethnic, seemingly all against all. This is not the revolutionary, disciplined violence channeled methodically against colonialism that Fanon theorized in The Wretched of the Earth as the only adequately dialectical response to colonial violence. I unexpectedly found myself compelled to convince my students. This is not what Fanon was talking about. I tried to convince them once they were ready to get with his program, suddenly. Indeed, as one of the militants with the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta quoted in The Curse of the Black Gold notes, we are not communists or revolutionaries. We are just extremely bitter men. My reading of the contemporary nightmare of the Niger Delta as the success, in some ways, of Saro-Wiwa's struggle is admittedly perverse, but it does serve as a deeply troubling example of the unintended consequences of movements, whether violent or nonviolent, for environmental justice. Taken on their own, in isolation from their consequences, some of the legal and fiscal developments in Nigeria since Saro-Wiwa may sound like progress, but as represented in The Curse of the Black Gold, at least, they look more like apocalypse. And just to give some explanation of this photograph, which is from this book, oil extraction has decimated fishing in the riverine space of the Niger Delta. So this is taken at a slaughterhouse, I think is too much of a term. But so goat meat has replaced fish as the source of protein in the diet. My second caveat has to do with imagining alternatives to the disseminationist progress narrative that envisions the West as the source of an environmental concern that will turn the tide of ecological crisis. If we must leave such narratives behind, what kind of alternative model of solidarity among humans in relationship with the non-human can offer a more just and sustainable future? The most obvious rubric is the planet, and I have noticed in both comparative literary studies, as well as the nascent discourse of postcolonial eco-criticism, a shared anti-Eurocentric or anti-US-centric impulse and an attempt to engage in new forms of world imagining. Among eco-critics, for example, we see Buell looking for an emergent global environmental culture, Heise articulating an eco-cosmopolitan alternative to American localism, Dean Curtin calling for the emergence of a global environmental citizenship that seems not entirely incompatible with Vandana Shiva's idea of Earth democracy, to which I will return in a moment. The embrace of the planet as a scale for ethics, imagining, and action also seems evident outside the scholarly realm in developments such as Pope Benedict's March 2008 statement on sin. By emphasizing questions of harm and responsibility in social and globalized terms, Benedict invited Catholics to consider the responsibility for pollution and ecological harm on a planetary scale as a source of sin, or a form of sin. At the same time that the Pope's statement on pollution as global sin was getting media airtime, scientists revived the idea that the Earth may have entered a new geological epoch, dubbed the Anthropocene, reflecting the massive effects of human activity on the Earth that far transcend climate fluctuations and earlier epochs. What, we must ask, before getting too far down this road toward planetarity, does it mean to think like a planet? Or to read for the planet, both with a sense of advocacy, reading for the sake of the Earth, but also reading for images of the world as a conceptual, social, or ecological whole? On the one hand, to think in planetary terms seems to be preferable to a blinkered localism or a disseminationist model of progress that divides the world between West and Rest. Rachel Carson concluded in 1962 that it is not possible to add pesticides to water anywhere without threatening the purity of water everywhere. And it is hard not to hear in this statement an anticipatory echo of Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement a year later, in his letter from Birmingham jail, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Anti-colonial thinkers from Nehru to Lumumba make similar claims about the fragility of any one nation's independence